Welcome to Novel Romantics, a podcast about contemporary American fiction. I'm the host of Novel Romantics, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. Today we'll be discussing the short story collection, What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky by Leslie Neka Arima. And my guest today is Nadifa Mohammed. Nadifa Mohammed was born in 1981 in Hargeisa, Somaliland. At the age of 4, she moved with her family to London. She's the author of Black Mamba Boy, The Orchard of Lost Souls, and most recently, The Fortune Men, which is actually so recent. It was like 2 weeks ago as of our recording that it was published. She has received both the Betty Trask Award and the Somerset Maugham Award, as well as numerous other prize nominations for her fiction. She was named as one of Granta's best young British novelists in 2013. Welcome, Nadifa, to Novel Romantics.
Hello, Doug.
Thanks for coming along. As I said, today we're going to discuss What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky by Leslie Neka Arima. So normally this is the part of the podcast where I say we're going to avoid giving any spoilers or anything like that, but we're dealing with a short story collection today, and it's kind of hard to talk about a short story without giving spoilers just because of the nature of the form. So basically, my advice to you, dear listener, is to either roll with the spoilers and you'll know what you're getting into when you read the book, or like stop listening right now, go read the book, come back, and then Nadifa and I will spoil it for you then. Anyway, I would like to start with a story that, in fact, Nadifa, you introduced me to, okay. Which kind of slightly blew my mind when I read it.
Why?
Why did it blow my mind? I'll tell you why in a second. The story is called Who Will Greet You at Home. It's right in the middle of the collection. The reason it blew my mind, or at least at first blew my mind, was the opening paragraph, which I'm going to read. The yarn baby lasted a good month, emitting dry, cotton-soft gurgles and pooping little balls of lint before Ogechi smashed its thigh on a nail and it unraveled as she continued walking, mistaking the little huffs for the beginnings of hunger, not the cries of an infant being undone. By the time she noticed, it was too late, the leg a tangle of fiber, and she pulled the string the rest of the way to end it, rather than have the infant grow up maimed. If she was to mother a child, to mute and subdue and fold away parts of herself, the child had to be perfect. And it's that really that opening paragraph, because I kind of knew exactly where I was in the story when I read it, and then also had no idea where I was in this story. I was like, is this about a real baby made of yarn? Is this some kind of metaphor? Is this like, you know...
Yes.
And then you find out as the story goes on, and it is real. It's a real baby.
But it's real and it's not real.
Yeah.
The whole world around it is kind of real and unreal. You're thrown into a situation where I think you want it to be real, but you know it can't be.
Yeah. I think that's actually really, I hadn't thought of it quite exactly that way. That you're absolutely right. You want it to be real because of the way she kind of tells the story, I suppose. Like she takes it at face value as real herself and tells you this unreal story in a very matter-of-fact way.
Yes.
That makes you want it to be real, right?
It's also gentle. The way it's told is pretty gentle, pretty matter-of-fact. In terms of who is the reader meant to be, that was something I never quite got to grips with, because it has these fantastical elements. The writing is very simple. It's not trying to tax you, or it's not overly or obviously philosophical. So it lulls you into the sense that this is a simple story, but it really isn't.
No, it's anything but simple, I think. I think that's one of the things that in general in this collection she does well is write. She writes simply without writing simplistically.
Yes.
And it's that matter of factness. So I recommended this story to a student I was working with this year because of that matter of factness of taking something that isn't possible. It's not possible that this is real in a realistic world, but the story that I want to tell is a story that has, I suppose, realistic intentions.
Yes. And I think that there's a truth to this story, which I think is what grabbed me. And it's the relationship between women in regards to children and the way that your value, your worth, your identity as a woman is so tied up in these creatures that you either bring into life or don't bring into life.
Yeah, or try to bring into life.
Exactly. So there was that. There was an electricity around that, which goes beyond the ways in which she tries to manufacture these children from string or cotton wool or leaves or whatever it might be. That weight of having to, of having your own worth tied up with that, that felt very real and very identifiable.
Yeah, I mean, it's there in that last sentence of that first paragraph. If she was to mother a child to mute and subdue and fold away parts of herself,
yes,
the child had to be perfect. That idea that she has to, there's something about herself that she has to absolutely, well, the word here is subdue, which is a pretty, again, it's so matter of fact, but when you start thinking about that, it's a really strong word. It's not like,
it
she
is.
Has to set aside, she has to subdue, she has to deny something about herself
and
in order,
fold away.
Yeah, in order to be, do this other thing that she desperately wants to do.
But the only reason she wants to do that thing is because she feels she has to. So the children are, they're manufactured, that's what they feel to me, as if they're manufactured. And you just made me think about an interaction I had a couple of weeks ago. Where I met a woman I've known pretty much all my life, or all the time I've lived in London. So she's seen me grow up from the age of around 6 years old. And she came up to me and she said, oh, you are so-and-so's sister. And I said, yes. And she said, have you had any children yet? Those two questions, basically, what I think I vaguely know you, I do. Have you had any children?
Yeah.
And I
said, as though that's not an intrusive question to ask.
I said no, and then she said, and that was that. That was the whole conversation.
Gosh.
And it was as if she was a supervisor walking around marking women as having had children or not had children. It, of course, has no bearing to her life, has little bearing on my life, and of all of the things to ask me, it was such an abrupt one.
Which is interesting, and I mean, aside from its own interest for you as part of your life, it's interesting to me as a literary thing. I don't mean it that way. But in relation to this story, because there's this figure in this story called Mama.
Yes.
Who runs this hairdressing salon, basically, but is also, she's basically like a mafia boss in this story.
Yes. Yeah, quite intimidating, quite scary.
Yeah. And she's almost dictating that these women, these young women who come to her shop and who, in the case of the main character of the story, work for her, she's almost dictating that they have babies and they come to her for her blessing to have their babies. And they, you know, there's this thing that gets repeated in the story that the main character doesn't have enough money to pay her for the blessing she needs to create a child that will grow and succeed and thrive and so on. And so she pays her with, you know, I just want a bit more of your joy.
Yeah. That's so creepy.
Yeah.
That's so creepy. And women do that to each other.
And well, I'm wondering, like, not that I'm trying to like do therapy for you, but like, I'm wondering whether there's something in that woman's response to you that's like, there's like, where's
she was trying to steal my joy.
She was.
And this woman in question is Nigerian, so I don't know if I fell victim like a drive-by attack. But you know, these elements, this cultural baggage is definitely present in Somali culture, but I can't, there'd be a little bit of a preamble amongst Somalis. You'd get to that question, but there'd be a bit of a preamble. But here there was no preamble.
And there's no preamble in the stories either, right? Like, there's a lot of these stories are about young or youngish Nigerian women.
Yeah.
Or even girls, children. And these kinds of pressures coming on them from, you know,
other women.
As assumptions or coming from nowhere.
Yes. And actually, there's very, very few men in this story. They're absent. It's a world where you don't need a man to procreate, so that they're not needed. And I can't, is there one male character at all?
In this story, I don't think there is.
If they do exist, they exist on the fringes of everything that matters. And with my interaction of the woman in the street, she didn't ask me if I was married or had a partner. It was, again, as if I didn't need that. I didn't need a man to procreate. The thing that was at stake was me and a child.
Yeah. The important thing you do is a child.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what makes me a woman of the world, or a woman in essence.
Except it doesn't, because in the story Wild, which is, I guess, the third story in the collection, it's about a young woman who has had a child. So she's done that thing that's expected, but not in the way that she was supposed to.
Of course. So there's a whole bunch of different failures ahead of you right there. It never ends. I think that's what's kind of depressing about the short story collection, is that it reveals the kind you get to one camp base of life, and then you realize there's another one a few thousand feet above you there, and you keep climbing, climbing.
Or sometimes it's even like an inch away.
Yeah.
but it takes you 1,000 feet.
Yes.
And sometimes they overlap, which is another interesting thing here. Like these stories are very international. They're all kind of contained domestic family or friendship stories that often span their characters. So in Wild, the character has emigrated from Nigeria to the United States as a child with her mother because her father has died. And she's about to go to college, but has basically, been naughty, I guess is the best way of putting it. It's not, and so she's kind of being sent back to the family to keep her out of trouble till she goes to college. But of course, the family back in Nigeria are in any number of intertangled troubles themselves. These are the kind of like, here's, I've arrived at this station, I've created some of my own trouble, now I'm being shipped off into somebody else's trouble to create more trouble with my trouble. And it's like, she's created for herself American trouble in America. And so the thing to keep herself from American trouble is to send her off to Nigeria, where she's just embroiled in all kinds of Nigerian trouble.
Of course. And that's,
which is also partly culturally confusing to her.
There's a specific Somali term for this phenomena. It's called Dagan Ellis, and it means returned to the culture. It's when you're sort of deported back by your family to be acculturated in the culture that you should be in, that you've neglected or you've fallen out of in the West. So often it can be done to very young children, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, but it's often teenagers, late teenagers, early 20s, who've got into drugs or whatever it might be in the West. And then they realize when they go back to Somalia, Somaliland, that the teenage lifestyle there is just as bad.
Yeah.
But their parents have got this pickled version of this kind of homeland where everyone is very religious and responsible and strict about their own morality and behavior. So they're caught between being told that they're not good Somalis, and then going back to Somalia and being told that they're boring and they're, they're not cool. They're basically not cool.
I was going to say, that's exactly what happens to this character in Wild, that she's like the cool, bad, like pot smoking, underage drinking American teenager who gets sent back to her aunt and cousin in Nigeria, who the cousin has a illegitimate child that everyone knows is her child, but no one acknowledges. Everyone calls her brother. And this becomes a kind of focal point of the story. That actually, the moment where that plays out in that story, I really like a lot, where there's just, you just watch the, like, what is literally a culture clash.
Yes.
Where this girl keeps saying obnoxious kind of American things in this situation that she has no reading of whatsoever. So she's blurting out all kinds of stuff and creating traps for herself and all the people around her.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's the strength of the whole collection, actually, is that she illuminates what it means to be constantly out of sync, or, you know, desperately trying to chase something that you can't obtain. And for some reason, I thought that Arima was Nigerian-American full stop, but she was born in London. So there's three cultures going on in her life. And it made me think about when I go back to Somalia and or Somaliland, and people say to me, they can tell that I'm foreign by the simplest of things, the way I walk, my mannerisms, never mind my accent when I'm speaking in Somali. You really are marked out, and this place that you're meant to belong quickly tells you that you don't belong. You're charged Westerner rates in the shops. It's just, it feels as if you are concocting, you're trying to concoct a home that doesn't exist for yourself.
Yeah. The way that the narrator of Wild starts to talk about exactly this thing in that story, she says, this is after there's been this huge confrontation and her cousins run off. She says, in the elevator, my limbs began to shake. I crossed my arms and the trembling moved to my lips. I'd always thought myself so savvy and grown, smoking in Leela's basement, kissing boys in hidden corners, maneuvering my mother with my smart mouth. I'd never felt as much a child as I did just now. And I think that's one piece of it, is like the way it makes you feel, that cultural disconnection suddenly makes you feel super naive.
Yes, and childlike. That's if you haven't met those markers of adulthood. It is that. And sometimes the children there are much more streetwise, tougher. You know, they'll mock you for not being as Somali as you should be. So it is, it's quite a humiliating experience.
And never even doubly go back so. Home.
Never, never. And it's only because I forced myself to keep going back that I've managed to kind of carve out a small world that I do fit into. But you develop a thick skin. You have to develop a thick skin for that to happen.
That's interesting. I wonder, that's another angle that you could look at these stories from, is like maybe a lot of these stories are about someone trying to develop that thick skin.
Mm.
None of these characters particularly have it. There's a couple stories that end with on kind of pseudo cliffhangers. And I think one of them works a bit better than the other one, I think, where the narrator has realized something. Oh, in fact, in one case, it's a narrator. In one case, it's just a protagonist. And it ends with them about to react.
Yeah.
Based on what they've just learned. And you don't know you never find out what the reaction is. And I wonder if that moment is partly about excavating some of that territory of like, oh, I've just become a little bit
harder,
yeah, and I've realized something that I can take a step forward, rather than being like what you described earlier is like, oh, there's another step 1,000 feet up.
Yes,
like this is like, oh, I'm actually in charge of this step. I've got control over this step, instead of being forced to make a step I don't want to make.
Yes, and that's a position of not despair, but of defeat in a way, where you stop trying. And I think you do have to stop trying. That's the only way you can have a more solid sense of self or any kind of stability is when you stop trying.
So I think that's true of one of these stories and not the other. I'm going to say what the stories are.
Okay.
and get into a bit more detail of that. Because so hang on a second. One of them is Glory, which has a fun starting. She's actually quite funny a lot.
There's lots of sly humor.
Yeah, part of that, like that plainness of her prose style. Because it's not like Hemingway plain. It's not this kind of like super terse thing. It's just, she's just very matter of fact, and it comes out as like kind of dry offhand humor a lot of times.
I found Mama quite funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, Glory starts with Glory's full name and how it runs afoul of Facebook's real name policy, which is a really it's this whole discourse on it. But that story ends with her. She gets involved in this relationship, and she's kind of lied her way into the relationship. The guy she's in a relationship has sort of lied himself. Yeah, and there's this moment towards the end where, let's see if I can find it. So there's a moment towards the end where, oh yeah, here it is. She says, it surprised Glory to realize that she had not been the only one scheming. Which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. It is. And I guess as well, with Nigeria being so famous for those, is it 419 scams? There's a particular term for them. And was it Yahoo boys and things that I love the idea that that's actually a part of the culture, that you're aware of groups of people being scammers and you also can become a scammer. It's almost, it's a subculture.
Yeah. Well, she's a total scammer in this story. Yeah. And she's pretty upfront about that. Like, she scams her way through everything. But this realization she has that, like, oh, wait a minute, I'm not the only scammer in the room.
And that gives a kind of chemistry, you know, there's an electricity in the air.
And then she has to make a decision about it, about that realization. And it ends with her making the decision, but it doesn't say what the decision is. And that seems kind of a bit of a kind of moment of despair to me in the way that you described it. And then there's this story, the last story of the collection, Redemption, which also ends with someone making a decision and like walking into a room to say something to someone. And you don't find out what they say, but it ends, I stepped into view and threw something of my own. And you're about to find out what she's going to say to somebody, which seems less, at least in my reading of it, that one seems less despairing. It might be slightly resigned to like, all these things have happened in the story. That story is about someone stealing some, this is such an amazing idea, even. Like, you go to church on Sunday and one of the families is entrusted to take home the bag full of the offering money, which proves how pious and whatever they are. But it's also like, it also then creates this, you know, the sin of pride, basically, of like, where like it's a big prideful deal to be so pious that you're trusted with this thing, and then you put it on display to tempt literally everyone who walks into your house, but also to show off to everyone who walks in and all this stuff
how trustworthy you are.
Yeah. And then of course, as soon as this bag shows up in the story, it's Chekhov's gun. You know it's going to get stolen, and you know who's going to steal it, and this person does steal it and whatever, and that's not even the end of the story. But it seems to me that she's in that story, she's learned something. She's maybe resigned to a certain way that the world works, but there's something much more like, to me anyway, of her taking control of the moment in her story there. And she's, the thing that she wants to say to this other girl is because she's like, oh, holy shit, I've learned a thing here that I can take and use and like, and be me with, in a way that the whole story, she's not really, she's always trying to ingratiate herself to people and stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And maybe that's one good thing about scammers, is that they've got maybe more self-acceptance, is that the right word? Or maybe they've got a more realistic understanding of themselves and other people.
Well, yeah, there's
striving,
there's an honesty to it. So you've given me the perfect opening to mention my favorite writer, Nelson Algren.
Who says
I'm slightly paraphrasing, but he says procurers and prostitutes are more honest than philosophers.
They are.
Which he was saying in direct reference to Simone de Beauvoir. So it's actually a really also very mean thing for him to be saying.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of his literature works that way as well. It's that these people know they're breaking the law, and it creates an honesty about who they are, like why they're doing and what they're doing. There's not like a pretense of, like, for example, to go back to the story, Wild, there's not the pretense of like, you've had this baby out of wedlock, and so we're going to pretend it's your brother, even though literally everyone in our society knows otherwise. And then when the girl says out loud, oh, you know, her brother's fine, it's like the scandal, because the omerta over what's happened has been broken.
Yeah. And you made me think something, that maybe a lot of the mental strife that people experience or seem to experience more commonly nowadays is caused by not wanting to accept your flaws, being unable to accept your flaws, finding them painful rather than coming to some sort of terms with them. People are now constantly looking for perfectibility.
Yeah, because it's, well, because the perfectibility, the question is like perfectibility in on whose terms or in relation to what, right? Like, so if Glory in the story, Glory is going to be perfect to her family and her fiance's family, she has to be someone who she just isn't and doesn't really want to be.
It's very common. And I think that pressure, like, Nigeria is a huge populous country and very competitive, much more competitive than Somaliland, just say, which has only got 3 million people. So that those layers of performance and of competition they must be so exhausting. And it's not surprising to me that so many Nigerian writers look at that. And, you know, it seems to me as if there's a lot of African writing coming out of Nigeria in particular, because the distance between the image people portray and their reality is just so vast, whether that's pastors, politicians.
Yeah, do you think that is particular to Nigeria?
I think it's very pronounced in Nigeria. It's definitely not unique. You can see it everywhere, but it's more pronounced in Nigeria. And also, I love, there's a kind of bombasticness to how people, how far people are willing to play a role. You know, if that's the big man with retainers all around him, and or the glamazon rich man's wife with the massive heels, the massive hair, like everything is just times 10.
Glamazon is an amazing term, by the way.
I've not had a chance to use it recently, so I'm glad.
Oh, well done. I'm glad you could break it out on our podcast.
And yeah, that's what excites me. It's partly what excites me about this collection as well.
Yeah, well, because I was just thinking as you were saying that, it's also interesting that in that respect, or in some parts of that respect, the ways in which then, again, the way these characters sort of, the way the author herself has moved around, like she's familiar and at home, at least to some, you know, we've just been talking about feeling not at home in different cultures, and the work you have to do to feel at home in different cultures, that all of which you can stake a claim to as being part of your own. She seems to have done a lot of that work, or is at least involved in a kind of deeply thought through or felt process of that, because she's writing these stories. Not all the stories are reflecting back and forth between the United States and Nigeria, but a lot of them do. And that it's interesting to think about the ways in which she presents them as, they're not mirror images of each other, and it's not like one of them is an exaggeration of the other or anything like that, but the ways in which they kind of bounce off each other and they kind of refract each other, I suppose, is really interesting to think about. That, like, all of this Nigerianness that you've just unraveled a bit for us, there's I was trying not to use the word concomitant because I'm not even sure I'm using it correctly. There's like a parallel. It's a much safer word to use. There's like a parallel Americanness that operates in some of these ways.
How do you see? Tell me more.
Well, one of the things that's interesting in some of these stories is that, coming back to that, you know, the piousness of who gets to take home the offering bag.
Yeah.
It's like that, the Christianity of the Nigeria that we see in these stories is, it's got a parallel to the evangelical Christianity in the United States.
And probably has its roots from that as well.
Well, I think I've thought about this before outside of the context of literature. And I think there's a kind of strange, I don't know the history of it. It's not my
Me
territory,
neither.
But like there's a strange kind of cross-pollination between them, because that American evangelical Protestantism certainly is something that Americans in particular worked really hard, not just, but I mean, the British were doing it before the Americans even, but like Americans in particular, mission, that sense,
yes,
of mission, going to far flung parts of the world and, you know, handing out Bibles to the locals.
Africa
and China and Vietnam and all, like literally every, like the whole world, anywhere where they didn't think there was enough Jesus. And, you know, it takes hold in some of these places.
Yes, and there's a real Americanness to Nigeria, I think. You know, I've not been there, and I'm only kind of talking about what I've read and heard from friends and various things. But it's also, I think, partly the reason that Nigerian immigrants to the U.S. do so well.
Yeah,
is that they've already been Americanized in Nigeria.
It's like it's already a work hard and get ahead culture.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Not every man for himself, but almost.
Yeah.
And that evangelical Christianity as well on top of it, which is also, you know, it's a prosperity gospel thing. It's a, you know, if you are beloved by God, then you are rich, because why would God keep you poor? All of that makes it quite an exciting place and quite a specific place within Africa. And speaking of the missionaries, I didn't realize that they have so many young, I rarely ever see young Americans in Africa unless they're connected to a church. Mm-hmm. And then in Kenya, in Uganda, in West Africa, they're all over the place. It's one of the chief connections culturally between America and Africa is that evangelical Christianity.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Barbara Kingsolver writes about it in the Poisonwood Bible in Democratic Republic of Congo.
All right. I haven't read that book.
You should. It's very good.
Okay, I will.
It's something that, and there's also like, if I was to write, if I had the energy to write at the moment, one of the things I'd love to write about is this case in Uganda of a young American woman who went there and opened a clinic for children and was serving in inverted commas, hundreds, if not thousands of African children. And she had no medical qualifications at all.
Oh my God.
And dozens of children died in her false care. She was injecting them with things. She was doing all sorts. And then she fled Uganda when all of this was revealed. And she's hiding out in America, hiding, you know, kind of unnecessarily, because it doesn't seem as if anything will happen to her. But this case is so shocking and so blood boiling. And she's you know, she's given interviews explaining her version of events. And it just really, really terrifies me that she was able to get away with what she was doing in Uganda.
And was she doing it under, like, the auspices of the church and stuff?
Or, yes. Know. Yeah. She was claiming all of these. She was claiming lots of money, donations, because she was doing all this work for young African children.
Gosh.
Terrible, like really scary. Yeah. And another thing that's connected to a degree is the environmental missionary type. And I can't remember her name right now, but the woman who wrote Where the Crow Dads Sing, her husband also fled Africa because him and his son shot a man dead, and they accused him of being a poacher and shot him dead, and then fled the country with her.
Gosh.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I can imagine now there's probably a lot of these different cases. It's very Joseph Conrad. It's very 19th century, but it's happening right under our noses in the modern age.
That's something that we think is sort of doesn't happen, or is safely contained in a past history of empire.
Yes, yeah, a distant one, not even a 1950s one, but an even further back one.
But it's actually a very present part of
our lives and our cultural lives as well.
Sometime over the winter, I rewatched The African Queen, which I hadn't seen in a long time. And the opening in particular of that film is really interesting in that respect, because it's not that long ago, at least to my way of thinking. It's the Second World War that film is set. And it's full on exactly that kind of missionary. It's like they've set up, these British people have set up this little village and Christian colony, and are, you know, the man and his sister are ministering everything from religion to, you know, economics and medical care and everything to this colony of Black African people.
Yes.
That then the Nazis come in and destroy. Like, I was really struck watching it by the optics of what was going on in this really strange, what I thought found really strange as an opening to the film, not strange in any bad way, but just like thinking about it in 2020, 2021. And it's not that long ago. And it's like, well, Humphrey Bogart's character is this Canadian who is therefore British at that time, which is weird as well. And then it's the idea that somehow it's just, I don't know, the way the Nazis come in and raise this village and everyone just looks to these two Christian missionaries to like help them out. And it's not presented in a way that I think, like, you know, when you read Things Fall Apart, that you necessarily find approval for.
I've just pulled up something about this woman, the one in Uganda. Her name is Renee Bach. And she turned up in Uganda as a 20-year-old. One of very many American teens who were working with evangelical churches in a town called Jinja near Lake Victoria. So from the age of 20 to 25, she took in inverted commas, 940 malnourished children, and 105 of them died. and she's now being sued in a Ugandan civil court.
It's amazing, like 20 years old, and
yeah.
So this comes back to your young, like you see all these young, very young Americans doing things like this.
Yeah.
Not just Americans, so let it be said. But
to be honest, you don't see many Europeans doing it. It is quite an American thing.
Yeah, it is like an American evangelical project.
And they pick one place and they go in en masse so they don't suffer as much culture shock and they can live their lives together. And then they run amok. So, yeah, I would like to write about this. I don't know when or how, but there is something really shocking and engaging about it.
What the one story in this collection that I don't quite know what to do with, and I'm wondering if that's the thing to do with it, or at least in part to do with it, What is a Volcano? Which is the only story in this collection that is presented not as... So we talked earlier about the kind of... with respect to Who Will Greet You at Home, that it's like, it's not a magical realist story, but it has things in it that aren't real that it asks you to... It asks you to want to believe are real and to accept that are real. And the narrator and the author certainly accept as real.
Mm.
And there's other stories that operate in similar ways. There's one about where the dead mother comes alive out of a photograph and lives with them for one night at home. And that functions in a similar way, a less successful way, I think, ultimately, as a work of fiction. But then there's this one story that is just kind of a fable. What is a Volcano? And it's about warring animals. And I wonder if some of that, or at least one lens to put over that story, could be this kind of thing you've been talking about, that there's something there about the ways in which cultures, unlike the characters that I've been talking about, we've been talking about, that where it's like this one character traverses these cultures and bumps up against their own sense of identity within these cultures, whatever, where these cultures transport their identity someplace and don't really necessarily seek to adapt it or don't think of it as something that needs to be adapted, and the kind of wreckages that causes, that maybe that's something I'm gonna have to go back and reread this story again and start thinking about that, because I reread it this morning and still couldn't quite.
And also what you just said about this what we would kind of call magical realism, I think the idea, and I played a little bit with magical realism in my own fiction, and it's not because I wanted to write magical realism, it's because sometimes people's cultures and experiences go beyond what we consider realism, but it's just as solid and believable to them. So just say the picture of the mother that comes alive.
Yeah.
All of the funeral practices that would have been common in all the different ethnic groups within Nigeria and West Africa and beyond have all been suffocated under either a very orthodox Islam or evangelical Christianity. So all of the ideas about what happens to someone once they pass away, what happens to their spirit, what happens to these ancestors who were for millennia there to look out for you, be part of your life in an active sense. It's as if Arima is allowing that older history, that older belief system, similarly with the babies that can be made from things, it's all interacting with a much older culture and belief system and philosophy.
Yeah, it's like she's stitching them back together through someone's experience of it.
Yes, yeah, which is pretty lovely. And then it takes away some of the horror aspects. I think sometimes people have described these stories as horror, but they're not really horror. I didn't feel afraid at any time, and it wasn't trying to engage that sort of excitement in you of fear. It pulls at your doubt, maybe. That's what makes it slight. That's where the tension comes from, is doubt.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a kind of, I mean this in a very particular way, but it's there's a kind of grotesqueness to it that there, and not in a horrifying grotesque way, but that there's just something slightly
out of shape.
Out of human shape with it.
Yeah.
That while at the same time it insists that it is a human shape, and it's, and like how you recover that or recuperate that as someone writing the story or reading the story or thinking about the story or talking on a podcast about the story ends up being the thing at stake.
Yeah, I think it is about being out of shape, a world being out of shape and individuals being out of shape.
There's a paragraph in What is a Volcano that I've landed on while we've been talking that I think gets into this as well, and perhaps also explains a little the kind of lens I was talking about earlier of the ways in which these cultures collide in ways that are obviously bad and worse for some people than others, but bad in all the directions. This is just from the middle of the, or actually, yeah, the middle of the story. It says, "The only one who felt the rage of river multiplied by that most powerful feeling that won't let a person rest, guilt. River's sister, not quite goddess, the guilt turned in her belly like a ship in a storm. She'd slept while her sister's children were taken. Blame, so like a god itself, shadowed her, occupied her bed like a lover, whispered to her like a dearest friend. Her name was eventually forgotten. Soon, all called her She Who Betrayed River, a name that over the years degenerated to Betrayed River, then Bereaver, which stuck, and eventually even Bereaver forgot that she had ever been anyone else. Guilt crushed every milestone in her life to dust so that she knew only before and after, and before seemed like the unfathomable dream of a foolish woman." And I think if I spent like 20 minutes that we probably don't have right now talking through that and really in quite a lot of detail in respect to these ideas we're talking, it's all kind of in there. There's this mutilation that has occurred, like a kind of internal, in this case, mutilation of her sense of self through all of these different attacks to the sense of who she or who they as a, this whole story is a kind of allegorical story, who they are as forces, as natural forces, that they've become twisted into something that they weren't and don't even remember the thing, so that they don't remember the spirit that could, that the photograph doesn't, you don't need a photograph, the spirit is still alive if the photograph isn't there to remind you that it's not, and the spirit doesn't have to try and pull itself out of a photograph in order to assert this cultural and spiritual and religious and you know, familial identity and existence.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, that story didn't work so well just because I'm not so keen on allegory.
Me neither.
But it's worthwhile playing with that and seeing. It's always interesting for me to see how people read African literature, mm-hmm. and what they bring to it and what they look for in it. And I think it's not giving them necessarily what they want. And that's an interesting choice.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that point. And I wonder if that's maybe a nice way to finish our conversation today, that this book is really one that asks you to question some assumptions you might bring to I am reading a work of African literature.
Yeah.
I am reading a work of American literature. I'm reading a work of, you know, born in London, British literature. Where do we sit? And what are the assumptions that you want to bring to yourself, to your reading as a reader, say about yourself and also say about the work in front of you, the things that are, you know, the thing you're reading?
So which part was the question?
I'm not sure there was a question there. I was just sort of summing up. Maybe that's a...
Yeah.
Don't worry.
Okay.
It's not a job interview. Yeah.
It felt like a big question, so I wanted to make sure.
No, it was kind of... So it was a big question, but it's a big open question that I'm imagining the person who's been listening to us jibber-jabbering at each other for the last hour might want to answer themselves rather than...
I'll leave it to them.
Yeah, thank you. Nadifa Muhammad, thank you so much for joining me on Novel Romantics. And everyone who's been listening should rush to their local bookstore and buy The Fortune Men, which is hot off the, like, still burning off the press.
Yes, finger burning. But also, it will be published in German in September.
Oh, brilliant. So if you're listening in Germany, here's your big chance. You can look avant-garde and ahead of the game and read Nadifa Muhammad's novel, The Fortune Men. What's the title going to be in German?
Oh, I know it. I know it. I know it. The Geist von Tiger Bay. The Ghost of
Awesome.
Tiger Bay.
So, go to your local bookstore, get it, order it ahead of time so that there's a huge spike in sales when it actually hits the shelves. And keep your eye out for Nadifa when she's hopefully in Germany
Yes, in
promoting
Berlin,
it.
hopefully, September.
Thanks, Nadifa.
Thank you, Doug. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the American Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.